Today at Reader's Corner, Bethany McLean, author of Saudi America, The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Fracking has upended the global energy map, transforming America into the world's top producer of oil and natural gas. With the influence of Saudi Arabia and Russia shrinking as the goal of energy independence comes into focus, America's energy policy would seem to be on a clear and positive trajectory. But the truth? A lot more complicated than that. In her new book, Saudi America, The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World, Bethany McLean uncovers the reality of America's fracking boom. Looking at the economics of capital investment and net debt, McLean paints a picture of a business where the massive returns promised to investors have yet to bear out. Bethany McLean is an author and journalist known for her work on the 2008 financial crisis. Her previous books include the bestseller Enron Collapse, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and Shaky Ground, The Strange Saga of the U.S. Mortgage Giants. She frequently writes for Slate, Fortune, and is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. She joins us today by Skype. Bethany McLean, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
Bethany, since you wrote your book, so many things are happening around the world, but certainly the one that has captured everyone's attention is the case of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian journalist who was abducted in the embassy in Turkey, the Saudi embassy. He didn't come out. He is presumed dead, if not killed, more than likely. We still don't know at the time of this interview what the outcome of that will be. But you have a quote in the beginning of your book which reads something like this: "If America doesn't need Saudi oil, does America need Saudi Arabia?" And I suppose it raises the question, as Americans, especially our leaders in Washington, ponder how to handle this crisis, what kind of penalties should be assessed on Saudi Arabia. I suppose it raises the question, what kind of flexibility do we really have here? And again, I'm not asking you to predict what the America is going to do, but give us an idea anyway, based on your research here, what are the parameters American officials are going to have to work within?
So I can't believe, in working on my book, that this whole concept of energy independence was something of a fraud. And I think the horrible case of Jamal Khashoggi shows that. You'll notice, amid all the headlines about this, no one is saying, well, just ignore the Middle East. We don't need to pay any attention to this. The problem is the ties go much deeper than our need for their oil. There are financial entanglements with the Saudi Arabian money entangled throughout Silicon Valley and indeed throughout our economy. In addition, this whole concept of us not needing Saudi Arabian oil because of American fracking, well, even if that were technically true, the rest of the world, namely our trading partners in Asia, depend heavily on oil from the Middle East. And if they were to not be able to get oil to power their economies, that would end up crushing our economy as well. We live in a global economy, for better or for worse. And I think this horrible event shows the limitations of our ability to just walk away from the Middle East, regardless of how much oil we're producing here.
I guess the flip side of this is this issue of American energy independence. What price do we pay for it? I believe you quoted our Secretary of the Interior as suggesting it was time to drill in national parks. I mean, you didn't have to quote him. That's something he's said any number of times. It raises the issue of whether or not American energy independence is pursued at the risk of damaging some of our great natural treasures in this country.
I think that's a great point. And when you realize that the concept of energy independence is in itself something of a fraud, it's these words that presidents going back to the 1970s have talked about. And maybe back in the 1970s, when people first started saying it, and the Texas Railroad Commission could set the price of a barrel of oil, maybe it made some sort of sense then. But it's become this catchphrase over the decades that no longer makes any sense in a global economy where the price of a barrel of oil is set by global markets. And so the the price that Americans are going to pay at the pump is going to depend on events happening in places like Libya and Nigeria and, yes, Saudi Arabia, regardless of how much oil we're producing here in America. And then once you start to think through the fact that those words don't mean anything, it seems all the more absurd to be drilling crazily in the name of something that doesn't exist anyway.
In your book, you do talk about the new Saudi ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, and you go through some changes that he has initiated that I guess you could say thickens the plot when it comes to the Saudi domination in oil production. Could you help us understand what he has done that's different than his predecessors and what role that's going to play in this uncertainty right now about where America and Saudi Arabia wind up?
Yes, well, MBS is a very complicated character, and I think we're just beginning to appreciate the extent of the complication. But one of the things he's done on the economic front has been to unroll this plan called Vision 2030, which was essentially a plan to wean Saudi Arabia's economy from its dependence on oil, because he recognizes that at some point oil is going away. Renewables are going to take over, and he wants Saudi Arabia to have something left at that point. So part of this plan was to take Saudi Arabia's state oil company Aramco public, and it was supposed to raise an enormous amount of money that Saudi Arabia could then invest in revitalizing its economy in other ways. The huge problem, and it really is a problem, is that the Aramco IPO is likely not going to happen. MBS says it will still happen around 2020, but it's been delayed in part because of a lack of transparency around its finances, in part because I think investors all over the globe are leery about putting money into a gigantic oil company when it's not clear how much longer oil is going to rule our world. And it creates not just the contradictory and complicated nature of MBS's character, but the financial condition that Saudi Arabia is in combined to create a lot of uncertainty in that country, which I think is quite a scary thing for us and for the world.
Now, of course, your book is going to wind us up at a place where we are very skeptical of the role that fracking can play in American energy independence. But before we get there, let's go back to the beginning. If you could just tell us briefly about Aubrey McClendon and Chesapeake, and maybe a little bit then about EOG, which is the renamed Enron, which, of course, you're so familiar with, given the smartest guys in the room. Perhaps you could enlighten us.
Absolutely. So one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is that as a business reporter, I'm always looking for these larger-than-life characters, these people who make that old adage, truth is stranger than fiction, come to life. You couldn't make up a character like Aubrey McClendon. He's the guy that, while most people don't give him credit for the technology of fracking, he's the guy who is the pioneer in what is the other critical part of the fracking revolution, which is capital. This guy was a master salesman. Over his years running Chesapeake, he raised about $30 billion in equity and debt from Wall Street to fund Chesapeake's operation. He raised another $30 billion plus from investors all over the globe in various forms of complicated financing transactions. I mean, think about the sheer magnitude of that money the billions that he was able to raise. And without those billions of dollars that were raised, the fracking revolution would never have taken off the way it is. And because I really focused this book on this critical element in fracking that I think most people don't understand well, which is not chemicals, but capital. Aubrey McClendon, to me, was the way to tell this story. And it's just an incredible story. He dies under somewhat mysterious circumstances in the spring of 2016. And it looks like an exclamation point that is going to mark the end of this fracking revolution, which didn't turn out to happen. And so the other side of the story, very ironically, is actually a company called EOG, which is the old Enron Oil and Gas. And it couldn't be a more different culture than Enron. EOG is, you go to see them in Houston, and they have an unmarked, basically not very nice offices as part of a larger, you know, office tower. There is low cost and kind of under the radar and focused on returns for shareholders and doing things the right way, as you possibly can be, really engineers at heart, who try to appreciate and respect geology. They're regarded as the Apple of shale, people said, or the Harvard of shale. They're the best regarded company in the industry. To be fair to the industry, I tried to show that there were two sides to this. There's this kind of crazy risk-taking, you know, put billions of dollars of capital into the ground and nothing comes back up approach to it. And then there's a much more measured and sensible approach.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Bethany McLean, author of Saudi America. Well, let's talk a little bit about the flip side, the underbelly of this fracking industry, and that's the type of debt that lies under these mountains of money. You clearly distinguish these problems in your book and cause us to question whether or not fracking's really going to pay off, whether it's waste, overpaying for land and leases. Again, could you elaborate on some of these?
Yeah, great question. So I think people didn't broadly understand this issue. Everybody knows the controversy about fracking and the environment, right? What people don't realize is that fracking is also very financially controversial. There are a number of smart skeptics who look at this business, and as one of them said to me, billions of dollars have gone into the ground and nothing in the form of returns for shareholders has come out to this point. And that's because fracking is really expensive, and the decline rates on the wells, meaning that a well might produce a lot of oil and gas in year one, but it produces significantly less in year two, means you have to keep reinvesting in the business. So it's not like you invest and then you get cash flow. You have to invest and reinvest and reinvest and reinvest. And so skeptics say you're never going to be able to outrun the required capital. And so it's always going to be, from an operating perspective, cash flow negative, which means it relies on outside financing. It relies on people being willing to give these guys money in order to make the whole thing run. And so the real question at the heart of my book, not so much that this is going to be a financial crisis, but it's almost more of an existential one. If the industry had to make money, if it had to live on its own cash flow instead of being able to raise capital and fresh capital from investors, if the Ponzi scheme-like aspect of this went away and the industry had to live on its own cash flow, how much oil and gas would we actually be producing? And for how long would we be producing it? And smart people I spoke to from my book thought it was significantly less than what we're producing today.
You know, here at Reader's Corner, we read The New Wild West, the story of fracking in North Dakota. And as I remember the book, there were a few references there about landowners who really made lots of money. And I think part of your argument here is overpaying for land and leases. Could you help us understand that?
Well, it's one of the reasons that fracking has been so divisive for communities. And I would recommend, if people are interested in this, Eliza Griswold, who's a New Yorker writer, has a great book out called Amity and Prosperity on fracking in the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania. But the issue you point to, that some landowners have made enormous amounts, is why this is so divisive, because you have people who have gotten paid a lot, because in America, you own your land and you own the mineral rights. So companies have had to pay individuals for leases to drill on their land. And it's resulted in some people making a lot of money, while others in the community who perhaps happen to be near the site but not directly on it have borne the downsides of fracking without getting the economic upside. And so that whole issue, it's not as simple as people who live in an area where fracking is taking place being against it. It's actually much more divisive than that, because some people are making quite a bit from it while some people are bearing the burden of it.
You also point to skeptics on Wall Street like David Einhorn and Jonathan Temper, who have been much less bullish about U.S. shale oil investment. Do they make the point you were making earlier, or is there another layer of criticism here we should be talking about?
That's really their point. And I liked the financial point by these guys who are just, they're Wall Streeters, right? They're not looking at the environmental costs or the divisive nature of this for communities. They are simply looking at the business models and saying, from a purely financial standpoint, this just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make money. And so I liked that, because it's a very clean argument, right? It doesn't attempt to take into account environmental costs and other things, which are important, but which also muddy the conversation a little bit. No, that's the heart of their argument, is that the business model just doesn't work.
How has technology changed the playing field of the new oil boom?
So that's one of the reasons that the business didn't go away. It hit a huge downturn in 2015, 2016, when the price of oil was falling and Saudi Arabia did not cut its production. And many people saw that as an attempt to kill the U.S. fracking industry. Instead, the industry came roaring back. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. But one of them is technological improvements. And so believers in this industry say, yeah, the industry hasn't made money, the profits aren't there, but they're going to be there, because we're making all these technological improvements that enable us to get more oil out of wells at a lower cost. And so just because it hasn't worked yet doesn't mean it's not going to work.
Just out of curiosity, when you talk about these technological improvements, what impact do they have on the land, on the people around the land? I have this feeling that doesn't necessarily mean life is brighter for those living near fracking.
No, I don't think it does mean life is brighter. And one big issue, the Texas Tribune actually just did a great investigation into this, that is looking at what happens as West Texas becomes, as they put it, the extraction capital of the world. And the water demands of this industry, among other things, are just absolutely enormous. So no, it doesn't necessarily mean that fracking becomes better. What it could mean, and I'm somewhat skeptical of this, but what it could mean is that the financial aspect starts to make more sense.
So what's the impact of the shale revolution on our relationship with China?
So it makes the relationship with China and our global economy more interesting in the sense that now we are exporting a decent amount of oil, and it's growing all the time to China. And that allows China to retaliate against us. When we say we're going to put tariffs on them, they can say, and we're going to tax your oil imports. This goes back to the question of how much oil can we produce for how long? I think a lot of the geopolitical impacts are things that people think are going to happen. When you try to point to what's actually happening today, it gets a little more difficult. We thought we would see a lot more than we have so far.
Well, I tell you, it sure raises the issue of what the future of alternative energy is. Or is the U.S. missing the boat by not focusing more on alternatives than this constant effort to send fossil fuel someplace else?
I think that the constant effort to send fossil fuel elsewhere is distracting us, and I think that's a huge mistake. Because I was really struck by talking again to financial people who aren't interested in the environmental aspects. They're interested in what's going to make money. And some of them are no longer investing in fossil fuels because they believe the dawn of the age of renewables is close enough that fossil fuel investments are not going to make sense for long. And there's a broad sense that America is behind in the race to develop renewables. We're behind on battery technology, we're behind on solar, we're behind on windmills. And so I've come to worry that kind of beating our chest about this concept of energy independence and saying, look, we're energy independent, or as President Trump has said, energy dominant, when that's a mythical concept in the first place, but while the world is moving on, risks us being leaders in the world as it was and being laggards in the world as it's going to be.
That reminds me of your quote. You quote Charlie Munger, who is one of Warren Buffett's sidekicks and a major investor. He says, "We should conserve our resources and use others." And I assume he's referring to the argument that says, look, we don't know what's down the road, and if we still have fossil fuel in the ground, we should be saving it for a time even more uncertain than the present. Maybe I haven't stated that absolutely correctly, but could you address this issue of those who are telling us that it's foolhardy, try to send so much oil someplace else when we should be conserving it here?
Right. So anytime you can get the chance to talk to Charlie Munger, you have to talk to Charlie Munger, right? And I had heard that he had views on this, and so I talked to him, and it's really fascinating because his view is that right now there's no substitute for hydrocarbons use in fertilizer and in products that we depend on to be able to feed our nation. And so forget about energy security. What about food security? And so his point is, sure, there might be a replacement someday, but there isn't right now. And so hydrocarbons are, like, in his view, the topsoil of Iowa. You should use it as slowly as quickly rather than as fast as you can. And right now, we're using it as fast as we can at prices that don't even produce a profit. And when you think about it, it seems insane.
I'm Bob Kuster, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Bethany McLean, author of Saudi America. In the book, McLean questions the economic sustainability of the fracking boom in America. Well, I have to let you deal with President Trump's attempt to put coal back on the map. Could you comment on what the war on coal is going to get us in the future?
Sure. I mean, I grew up in a mining town, and I am sympathetic to the plight of miners and as their economic well-being gets pulled out from under them. That said, it isn't Obama's war on coal that killed the coal industry. It's actually fracking that killed the coal industry, because the advent of cheap natural gas as a result of fracking has made it more financially sensible to use gas instead of coal. And so I think it's an example of incoherence interference in President Trump's administration's energy policy to be celebrating fracking and what it's doing for us while also talking about trying to bring back the coal industry. That said, the United States has never had a particularly coherent energy policy. So while I may criticize President Trump for being incoherent, it hasn't always been a lot better than that in the past.
This kind of takes us back to what Saudi Arabia's 2030 plan was. We talked a little bit about it earlier, but in a sense, they seem to be a little bit ahead of our thinking as far as the dependence on the fossil fuels is concerned, aren't they?
Well, there's a great irony here, especially if you think about the criticism Saudi Arabia is getting today for its allegedly very backwards way of handling its problems. And yet here they are investing heavily in renewables while we're mining sand in Wisconsin and trucking it down to the Permian Basin in Texas in order to put literally tons of sand into the ground to extract oil and gas. And so you think, huh, wait a minute. And so I think we should be moving ahead on all fronts. And the idea that we're neglecting investment in renewables because we're so proud of ourselves for all the oil and gas we're producing, it seems crazy to me.
Well, let's close your interview here by talking a little bit about the three scenarios for fracking and U.S. energy independence. Help us understand these three scenarios and where you think we're going to wind up.
Right. So one of the humbling things about working on this book was realizing that everybody who's attempted to predict the future of fracking, and in fact, everybody, most people who've ever tried to predict the future direction of oil prices has been wrong. So I finally ended up with finding this great research firm who has basically laid out these three scenarios for what the world could look like. One involving a quicker transition to renewables than anybody sees, where oil and gas start to decline. Another of more of the status quo of where we are today. And a third, a situation called vertigo, where it takes longer for renewables to change the world than people expect. And we continue to need oil and gas. And there continue to be these giant spikes in the price of oil as oil production doesn't meet demand. And the interesting thing is that provides a framework for thinking about what the future might look like rather than a certainty about what it's going to be. And I found that the most interesting way to think about it, because it makes you think, well, what should we do to prepare for a world that could be any of the above? And to me, it would mean a heavy focus on renewables, some humility about our level of oil production and how sustainable that might be, and perhaps more of a focus on natural gas, because natural gas has resulted in a great decrease in carbon emissions relative to coal. And while there's a lot of controversy about the methane involved in natural gas, if the industry would control leaks better, they could. And if we were to convert our transportation grid, our transportation to natural gas, we actually could have something closer to energy independence than we ever will with oil.
One more question about fracking, Bethany. What's interesting about your book, of course, is the fact that you have based your concern over fracking around all the issues but the one that is environmental. And I mean, you mentioned that, of course, but I mean, your focus is financial, your focus is geopolitical. But of course, if you look at a book like The New Wild West, you don't have to read a book like that to know that across the country, Oklahoma, for example, there's all kinds of concerns that fracking may even be causing an increased number of earthquakes in that state. And I guess I'm interested in what role you think damage to the environment plays when it comes to the future of fracking, as opposed to all the very good reasons you've given in your book as to why fracking still hasn't panned out, whether it's because of, you know, finances or whatever.
Right. Great question. And I think the two go hand in hand. And the reason I focused on the financial side of things is because I don't think it's as well understood as the environmental side. I think most people, if you say fracking, they recognize there's environmental controversy. Most people do not recognize that there's financial controversy. And this is, it's a mini book. It's meant to be a quick read. And the problem with a mini book versus a maxi book is you actually have to have a pretty tight focus. So I very explicitly said, look, this is not an environmental book. This is actually a book about the financial financial aspect of this. And that's both good and bad, right? It's a quick read, it's digestible, but it also means that it neglects some important issues. In some ways, as I alluded to earlier, I kind of liked the cleanliness of the financial argument, because it's coming from people who don't have a vested interest. They're not closet environmentalists. They're financial types on Wall Street who say this just doesn't work economically. But you could build a financial model that attempted to take into account the environmental costs. If you tried to appropriately price the water that fracking companies are using, for instance, if you tried to appropriately price some of the health concerns, you would end up with an industry that really doesn't present a viable financial picture. And so that would be another lens through which you could look at things. And I was thinking recently, it's really interesting because people will say, well, renewables don't work without subsidies. But if you start to think, well, what's a subsidy? Is a subsidy explicit money that the government is giving to encourage the use of wind and solar? Or is a subsidy the unaccounted for costs of water and health that are actually just given to the oil and gas industry? My point is, you could take the work that I've done and build a more all-encompassing model if you chose to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bethany, you're certainly known to be an expert on the 2008 recession. And I might add that a book I did not mention in your intro that you've written, The Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis, has been cited time and time again as one of the best, if not the best, accounts of what went wrong and how we got where we were in 2008. And I will ask as a closing question then, how did the Great Recession of 2008 spur the current unconventional oil boom?
So I love this because I love when there's connectivity that you don't see on the surface, right? But there's an argument that if it weren't for the financial crisis, the fracking boom would never have happened in the magnitude that it has. And the substance of that argument is that as a result of the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates to record low levels. And that enabled fracking companies to raise the mountains of debt that they have needed in order to spur this revolution. It also had another effect, which is that pension funds have been unable to make the returns that they need. And so they've been investing money in riskier areas, namely private equity firms and hedge funds that invest in credit. And those sources of money in return have been investing in fracking. So there's an estimate that about 30% of the hydraulic fracking that's going on today is being done by privately backed companies funded by private equity money. And that's also a direct result of the financial crisis. And so you can make this argument that what has happened would be orders of magnitude smaller if it weren't for the Federal Reserve's policies in the wake of the financial crisis.
Well, Bethany, you mentioned the size of your book. I'm not complaining about the size of your book at all. I think sometimes we freak out our readers when they go check out one of the books I've interviewed the author on here and find it's 400 pages long and they don't even pick it up. But this is one they can pick up and they can get a thorough understanding of the truth about fracking and how it's changing the world. Bethany McLean, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. I hope you couldn't hear the dog whining in the background. She's not happy about being woken up.
I've got one just like that. Not a problem at all.
All right. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
And under the category of what I am reading lately, I've been reading a smorgasbord of books, some of which are related to our recent travels in Europe. The Shetland Bus by David Howarth is the tale of the Norwegian named spy ring during World War II that organized trips by fishing boats from the Shetland Islands to Norway, thereby rescuing refugees from German-occupied Norway and supplying weapons and supplies back to Norway. These were dangerous journeys from 1,000 to 2,000 miles in length, and the Germans attacked those small fishing boats regularly, with the Shetland crews on them having no way of being saved. It was heroics of the highest order. I might add, this is a very old book that you'll have to get from the library if you're interested. Again, The Shetland Bus by David Howarth, H-O-W-A-R-T-H. And on the fiction front, I'm reading Nutshell by Ian McEwan. It's a very clever novel told by the most unusual narrator, the 9-month-old unborn son of a couple whose lives are reported and interpreted by their soon-to-be-born son, with a plot that is recast from Shakespeare's Hamlet. By the way, in addition to our Reader's Corner Twitter feed, I also have a personal Twitter feed, at Bob Kustra. That's at Bob Kustra. I retweet, I tweet, I comment on various issues in the political and natural world that you may find interesting. You are most welcome to follow me at Bob Custra. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.